Hello, we're back. It's Live at the Backyard Comedy Club with me, David Whitney, and...
me, Chris Evans-Daisy.
It's episode number...
31.
Is it 31?
I think so, yeah. Somewhere about there.
Who knows?
They know. They know more than us.
Yeah, probably. Well, they couldn't know less.
It's not possible. It could be possible, but let's take certain damage.
Unless they've had some sort of major head injury.
Yeah, that kind of damage. Yeah. Not just emotional.
Yeah. physical damage aside, we just had a lovely conversation with Mr. Paddy Lennox. Wonderful, charming man. I think you're going to enjoy it. It takes us a while to get onto the subject of comedy, so stick with it. but I think we had a great time, and I hope you enjoy it too. Release the terabytes.
I was going to say it.
Oh, God.
Good evening, how are we doing back, George? Yeah. It's nice to be here in the trendy East End of London. I've been here all day. I was in Shoreditch. I went to a very trendy Buddhist cafe for lunch. I had soup of the moment.
Ben Affleck, who, he's pretty much royalty in Hollywood anyway, so he can say what he likes, and he's playing the bad boy, I think. But Ben Affleck, did you see him in, I saw him on Graham Norton, this is a couple of, before Christmas, and everyone else has been jolly and happy and really nice and what have you, and he's sitting there like a fucking bulldog licking piss off a nettle, you know, he and after that, didn't realize he's alcoholic and da da da. It all makes sense now. He was just in a bad, angry place and was just gnarly with Graham Norton, who could be gnarly with Graham Norton? He's the loveliest, cuddliest man in the world.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, trying to go along with it and just wanting to move down the sofa to talk to someone else because he was such a prick. So I just think that guy's got so many
issues.
Fucking issues that he just opens his mouth and comes out with shite like that when you go, you know, let me get this right. From what you say, he's defending one case where he didn't rape a girl. So let's clap for Mr. Weinstein. Yeah. He didn't fuck that girl on one occasion. You know, God almighty, you're fucking clutching at straws.
Yeah, it just seems an unnecessary thing to put your head above the parapet for, doesn't it?
Yeah. I, at this stage, can you defend a man like that? I don't think you can. And even if you can on any one tiny little technical... Really?
Yeah.
It's not really...
Doesn't really...
So I tried to push back the tide a little bit at that point.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, I don't pay any attention to any of this shit.
No.
To large or less. I get up in the morning, I read my BBC News feed on my phone, and I get the Washington, and I get a couple other, you know, so Statesman and the Spectator and all that sort of crap that come in with various bits and pieces, and I just flick through it because it's always quite pressing quite well. And the more interesting thing, I think, is Aziz Ansari. Is that how we say it?
Aziz Ansari.
Yeah. I've the worst memory for names, so I am like Mrs. Malaprop. I will fucking get stuff from the arse end around them. But that poor guy and that poor girl in this situation of a date that went horribly fucking wrong, you know, and again, I don't know all the facts, but I kind of felt for both of them, you know, foolish guy, foolish girl.
Yeah.
You know, bad scenario. Really bad scenario, but I thought, fuck.
I don't know this particular news, so what happened?
So you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So my understanding, pick me up on this, right? Yeah. So he goes out on a date with a girl, and they go back to his place, and they have oral sex three times.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, fuck, three times.
I know.
I mean, that's just three.
It
three
doesn't
goes.
State if there was climax for each one as well, though. So I think that's quite important information.
Very important to see how the chronology and the time frame and da da da. Three times, of which she felt uncomfortable every time and verbally made and
she made some slight gestures to. Well, she doesn't state it as slight gestures because she came out anonymously saying, explaining what happened in this scenario, and she had explained that she didn't want to do it, but he continued and pressed. But it's become quite a divider, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Really, amongst those crowds, because a lot of the people that are, you know, anti, obviously everyone's anti-Weinstein, but everyone's really pressing on that subject matter, even they're starting to divide off into two sides of, no, that is still wrong, and others that are going, actually, in this situation, she could have left, the door wasn't locked, he wasn't forcing her, he just continued,
yeah.
And then she didn't just leave or stop it.
And his just said, reaction to the story is very much like a guy, I'm really sorry, that's not what I thought was going on.
Right.
And I, oh my lord, you know, exactly what you're saying, I didn't force anyone in anything, you know, do anything like that. So, what am I defending myself against here? Am I being accused? Am I being whatever? And he was being accused. And everyone started jumping on and attacking him. And then all the people attacking her, blah, blah, blah. And it's just one of those misreading situations. Without knowing how, you know, how serious he did or didn't instigate oral sex, or how much she didn't or did try to, say no. Or she kind of...
Consent is continuous, isn't it? Just because somebody says yes at the beginning of the evening doesn't mean they're continually saying yes. But, you know, if they have changed their mind, they do have to make it clear.
Yeah, I think, and poor this guy, he's got completely roasted.
I think we need a flag system, the way we used to have with driving.
Well, like fouls in American football.
Yes, American football that I know a lot about. Go.
As soon as you think there's a foul, you throw the yellow flag in the air.
Ah, right. Signals. You look at, or like even more impressive if you had some sort of flare gun.
If you go back to some man's apartment, he's got lots of flare. On the ceiling. Hang on a sec. What's that burn? What's that smell? Oh, don't worry about that. But in sailing, in yacht racing, you pull a little flag that's off your... Not a lanyard, that's the thing that ties to the thing. That holds the mast up. Yeah. And you pull it, so it flies out, so it's constantly flying. So you know you've called to the marshals a challenge.
Right.
And so it's always flying. So everyone knows, oh, they're challenged.
They don't want to have sex. They've got the don't want to have sex flag out.
Yeah, so maybe you have around your genitals
some sort of
flag you pull out, or trousers you pull up. Maybe that would be the signal.
Yeah. What different colour trousers? Because you could create a whole signalling system that would change the whole game entirely. Take that to the bars and the clubs. Because then there's no like, oh, are they in a relationship? I don't know whether to approach them. If they wear the colours or flags that signal our game.
When I was at university, we did the traffic light evening thing where you went along and you were given different coloured... There were different coloured badges when you came in. Red, amber and green, which means green... You're single, you're up to meeting someone. Amber, you're not really sure. Or university means it's complicated, which means you've got a boyfriend before you arrive to university. Yeah. And it, let's just see. And red, absolutely not. And I was dating now my wife so at the time. So I was always wearing red. And much as I love her very much, I was thinking, oh, fucking everyone else is just kissing. And we're standing in the corner going, this night's not really for us, is it? You know.
I'd imagine just greens and yellows would go. I don't see the point.
Point of red turning up. It just seems like you're gloating. I'm happy.
Showing off your chattels.
Yeah.
Both of you. Look, she's going, look what I got. For her being an English girl at university, I got imported mine. Here we are. Yes. I got an import.
Did you go to university in Ireland?
In England. London. Yeah.
Well, where'd you go?
I went to London University. I went to London University's... I went to University of London, Y College, which is down in Kent, which is...
Not in London.
Not in London. Oh. So I did agricultural economics.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you go from that to stand-up comedy?
Well, because I was meant to do medicine. All my family are doctors, and my dad said to me, I don't think you're going to get the grades. So I was doing biology, physics, chemistry, and did AO maths. Mm. And to be fair, he was absolutely on the money. And there's no hindsight in this story. And he said, choose something else. So I suddenly had to choose something, and I was going to go and do food science and nutrition at Reading University, because I always liked business. I always liked money and how to trade and hustle and all that sort of thing. And food science and nutrition is, as we know now, still then...
Snake oil.
It's palm oil. It's a great... I find fascinating. The world marches on its stomach.
Mm.
And to me, that's... If you want to make money, food industry.
Yeah.
Hence,
it's never going to go out of fashion.
No, mechanically reclaimed meat. You know, people still eat that shit, even though you see the way it's high pressured off bones and carcasses and stuff. Anyway, all that stuff. In fact, I had to choose a different subject. went to Reading, had a place in Newcastle upon Tyne, which was a better course. And I met some guys. I came over to London after my A levels, and met some guys who said, "Why are you going to Newcastle?" And I went, "Because it's a great course." And then they pointed out the weather patterns very much the same as Northern Ireland. And I thought, "Fuck!" And I was in London, and it was a heat wave. It wasn't. It was just London, but to Northern Ireland, it's just a heat wave. And they went, "You want to stay down here?" And I thought the southeast was just amazing.
London in the sun does feel particularly. It feels like you're in a Richard Curtis movie. Oh. You know, it just feels so romantic, London in the sun.
I was working on building sites. I came over, and within 2 weeks of my A-levels, I was working on building sites in London. First one was in Earl's Court, the old, what was called Terminal 3 building, where before transatlantic flights, you'd fly into London, not transatlantic, pan-world flights. Uh-huh. You'd fly into London, stay overnight in London. It's a British Airways own building.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they called it a terminal, and you flew on. So they bought that. They cleaned the whole interior out, and I was just a labourer on that side. And I earned 20 quid a day. 20 quid
what?
A day.
What? Yeah. When was this?
1987.
Wow.
So I was doing that, and then I went left there because there wasn't enough money and went to work in Tobacco Docks. So if you've ever been to Tobacco Docks over by St. Catherine's Dock,
yeah,
which is lovely, underneath the arches and stuff, I sandblasted all those fucking arches.
I spent a summer playing the Black Knight in the medieval banquet, which is now in Tobacco Dock.
Ah!
That they now have this sort of like Disney medieval banquet experience. It was horrendous. The food was just like, I mean, the kitchens were ravid with rats.
It was properly medieval. They were taking the theme a little bit too far. They had Black Plague and boils and susceptibles or whatever they call
it. Yeah, I mean, with no exaggeration whatsoever.
Not a vegetable in sight.
No. It was just like just some sort of liquidized meat. And genuinely, we'd be like having the sword fight and these big broadswords. And there were lots of bits where we had to accidentally miss and clang them off the stonework on the floor because it made a great spattering of sparks. And twice in one summer, when I went to miss and hit the floor, I hit a rat.
No way. Wow.
They were so just around.
Wow. You could so sell that to people. And like, they go, "You hit a rat." You go, "I know, we have to get them in. We're not meant to kill them because they're pets." Yeah. You know, it's a trained rat. You know, this is why you pay so much money.
It's
you know,
a stunt rat.
It's a stunt rat. It's a lambda actor.
Yeah, it would be a lambda actor.
Yeah, it's got to be lambda.
That is what is now in Tobacco Docks.
I've never been back, and I know there are restaurants. My wife, who works for a city firm, goes, you know, has dinners, and she was Tobacco Dock, and she said, "We must go there sometime." And I went, "No fucking way." I honestly nearly lost my religion. Because sandblasting's horrible in the best time. I don't know if you've ever sandblasted.
Never.
So you wear a big helmet that is compressed air blowing up through the back of it, otherwise you suffocate. And you wear leather with wire mesh gauntlets, and you have a visor that you tear off strips because the sand bounces back off the whatever you're blasting, which is the brick in this case, and just pits the visor. So you pull that off, and it pits your gloves. And so, I mean, you brush it over any bit of metal, it just strips it right. It's vicious. And also, with it, if you're in an archway, within minutes, you can't see anything. It blows dust up everywhere, and so you've got strip lights, and you're up on a scaffold, and it's just horrible.
And this was trying to sort of reclaim bits of the industrial docklands in order to turn them into restaurants.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was...
To make it all pretty stonework rather than... Tar
and I had to go up and they'd pull back the bit in the top and I'd spray it with this awful chemical. There was no health and safety at all, and it was just me doing this. And I went from 20 quid a day in the building site, and I think I got 35 quid a day for doing this.
Making it rain.
I thought I was the richest man in the world at that. And I was sleeping on a friend's sofa, and I remember going into London town bit, you know, and shopping and coming out with, I think, Next to the sale on or something, and I bought a shirt and I bought a pair of shoes. Blue fantastic kind of canvassy leather brogie type shoes that were just, you would never get in Ireland. And I just remember saying, look at these. I just loved it, man. It was hard work, but anyway.
And so
I left there, and I was going to go to Newcastle, and all these guys were saying, what do you do in Ireland? I said, well, I'm from countryside. I like shooting, and I like fishing, and I grew up. And they said, well, go to Y College. It's London University of London. Agricultural economics is a degree, because you go to the city afterwards, and you become a trader or an analyst or whatever like that. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And, of course, this is in 87, so everyone was a yuppie and making a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, well, I'll do that. And so I phoned up the university, told them my grades, which were quite reasonable, and the guy said, unconditionally, you're in. Okay. And I went, oh, okay. And he said, I'll phone up Newcastle, get you cleared. And I did nothing. And he said, oh, don't you want to come and see the place? And I went, no, I'll take your word for it. You know, and he sent me a prospectus in the post, because, of course, there was no internet back then. Mm-hmm. And I got off a train one Sunday evening. There was no one else at this train stop, and I stood there. I remember I had a leather suitcase, an old raincoat, and a trilby hat. That's all I had. And looking up and down, going, there's no one here. This is the biggest
mistake
of my life.
Sounds like the beginning of an Agatha Christie novel.
It felt that way, you know. And next thing, this guy stuck his head out and went, are you Paddy? And I went, yeah, that's me. And he went, right, we've been waiting for you. And I went up. And it went in the porter, very old school college-y type thing. Mm. And I went in to see the porters, and they went, oh, you're the last one we've been waiting for. And showed me up to my room, which I was sharing with someone, which had a balcony and a Latin school quad and oak panels and, you know, just like Bride's Head, just completely and utterly.
Amazing.
Just bonkers. And I came back to the porter's lodge and went, where is everyone? Oh, they'll be down the porter's lodge. They'll be down the union. I went, the union? They went, you know, the student's union. I went, oh, yeah, I read about that. So I walked the whole way through the college and got out to the, you know, and it was that, like a scene in a movie where you could hear it, and then you came up and opened these doors, and all the smoke came out, and this great music. I think it was New Order was playing. I remember it was New Order was playing. And I opened the doors, and the smoke came out, and some guys piled out, pissed out of their tree, you know. And I went in, and immediately was just became friends with everyone, and smoking, and beer was 80p a pint or something, yeah. And I had a full grant back then, 800 quid a term. It was just amazing. And
you do look, I mean, one looks back at bits of your youth and just think, oh, did not realise how good we had it.
Oh, absolutely. To this day, I feel, you know, amazingly. I came from Northern Ireland over here, had a full grant, full subsistence, they paid me to go to university, and I pissed it up the wall.
As you're meant to. And actually not a proper,
I mean,
education.
I came up with a 2-2, you know, I mean, I didn't like completely.
So a rifle.
I got a Desmond, yeah. So it was.
So how did you go from horticulture to comedy?
From agriculture. Oh, hortics are an odd bunch. We never mix with the hortics.
I did not.
Ed Burns a hortic. He's a quite
really?
Yeah, he's a horticulture guy. He was up in Scotland somewhere.
When you came out, did you try and get into the industry?
So, well, I came out and there's a big grain trading company called Louis Dreyfus, who, there are five companies that run the world grain, and it's a complete cartel. And I was had a graduate training scheme with them in the city, and much to their chagrin, halfway through my finals or at the end of my finals, I said, actually, I'm taking a year off. So I kind of, you know, and I was, it's a smallish company, but anyway, they went, okay, well, you really going to do it? I'm going to do it. Because I wanted to go to Australia to be a cowboy. So I went, because I just wanted to be a cowboy, you know. So I went to Australia and worked in cattle stations for the whole year.
You're still in costume.
And I've taken the spurs off because they clank, you know. But, and I went out there and I came back and it would have been the end of 91. And there was a recession, and I phoned my friends in the city, and you know, because I knew it was going pear-shaped. And one of my friends who worked for Louis Dreyfus said, there's no scheme. And I went, oh, shit, they've scrapped it. And they said, listen, you know, I'm probably going to get the bullet and all that sort of thing. So I got a letter from them saying, can you come in for a talk? And I remember phoning them up, speaking to the guy, nice guy, and said, look, I don't want to come in. Save me the bus fare. Just, I've not got a desk, have I? And they went, no. I said, okay. So I spent the next year trying to find a job in the city, like all the graduates. And I worked at Drury Lane Theatre as a red coat for Stall Moss and Cameron McIntosh. Met the Queen, Diana, did all those private entertains, all Sultan of Brunei, all just crazy. Simon Cowell, what's the actor?
Simon Callow.
Said something, propositioned me. I think it was propositioned, I don't know. I was in this tiny, if anyone walked into the theatre and you saw them come in, and they were celebrity. It was Miss Saigon. This is how long ago it was. You'd go on the company phone up the company manager and say, Simon Cowell's just walked in, or whatever celeb just walked in. And they go, oh, right, give them an entertain. So you go, brilliant. You go to the box office, find out where they're sitting, then you go to the bar and say to the bar, Mary behind the bar, I've got an entertain. Simon Cowell.
Callow.
Callow is in. And they go, right, brilliant. They look up the rooms and go, right, the ante rooms. Ready, not the royal room, but the anteroom off it. So, okay, and they give you a tray of canapes because they're in house chefs, champagne, yeah, all that sort of stuff. And you set up the room, lights will come up in the interval, and you'll be standing next to Simon Callow and go, hello, Mr. Callow, Cameron McIntosh would like to offer you a private room, sort of thing. And they'd all go, oh, wonderful, oh, thank you very much, wonderful, wonderful. And so we went up to this little room, and I'm standing in there, and I mean, I was, 23 or something like that, and you're wearing red tails, white tie, gloves, you know, you're just a butler basically. And the conversation was fairly stilted, you know, and then there was a pause,
the weather,
and sort of acting and sort of thing. And and he said, my, you do look incredibly
dashing
or something like that in that uniform. And it took me a while to realize, oh, I think he might be gay. And I went, thank you very much. I'm just going to get some more canapes or something. Excuse me. Went up to Mary and went at the bar and went, is Simon Callow gay? Which, at which point, there was all the bar staff pissed themselves going, oh, for God's sake, please. I was working, the only man working in theatre that couldn't tell a gay man, you know.
I like the Greeks. I kind of studied the Greeks. Wikipedia the Greeks. That's enough, isn't it? You know, they were the first ones to start up stand-up comedy. I don't know if you know that. They were great, you know, they were great debaters, which debating was the first sort of, you know, stand-up comedy, I think, you know, where they're very confrontational. They had a lot of heckling started from there. And it was the Greeks that in fact started the infamous put down of I fucked your mum. And they would shout that, I fucked your mum, and it worked, you know. Oedipus, he had a rough time with that.
So how did you get from working at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, oldest and grandest of
beautiful
Western theatres?
Beautiful theatre. They used to do every year, they used to do a picture of us in Theatre Royal Drury Lane, and with all the red coats in our red coats and the standing up looking in the royal room or something like that. And it was very regal, beautiful, beautiful. And there was a photograph taken which the man who always used to proposition me still has a copy of this. Where we're all standing there, and I've got my cock out. Because I thought I just couldn't resist it. It was just a serious sort of thing. And everyone's standing looking serious. And you would have to look very carefully to see my little champion. But it's just, when you see it, it's just, you know. It's, anyway, that I'm just excited.
Does that picture draw the holes?
I'd love a copy of that, because it's very, very funny. You don't notice it, because it's in black and white as well.
Well, it's like T-Wolf, the movie, that crowd scene, very famously, one of the extras has his dick out of the movie, and it made it.
Really?
On DVD today, on video.
On Teen Wolf? I'm going to Google that later.
Yeah, not the new TV series in high definition, the original Michael J. Fox movie.
I'm going to do that.
You can find the clip online.
It's suddenly going to crash the internet. Now
everyone's going to be piling on it. It'll be hard to load today.
So I left, when I was there trying to look for a job, I was working in the evenings. I did the evening job because I thought, then that will leave me free during the day to go into interviews and stuff and all that sort of thing, which it did. And but I went and I did a bit of acting at university, did a musical, did a couple of straight plays and stuff like that, really enjoyed it. And then I was at the Hurlingham Club. I don't even know how I got to the Hurlingham Club, through a friend, and they did, not the pajama game, they did some twee little thing, and I was in the chorus and that, and did a bit of that. And I thought, that's, you know, I remembered, oh, this is so much fun acting. Then I auditioned for Webber Douglas Drama School.
Oh, yeah.
Just thought, I'll give it a go. You know, I've done a bit of this, auditioned. And I got in. They kept one place over in the summer for late auditions, and I got this place to come in. So all of a sudden, that September was starting at Webber Douglas. And of course, it was fee paying, which was news to me. And it was £2,000 a term. They wanted £2,000 up front, £2,000 for that term. So you come with £4,000. And a friend of mine, who's very wealthy, contemporary, said, I'm writing you a check, you're going to go. And I was like, I'm not taking your check. I sent it back to him and said, look, I'm going to be able to pay this back if I'm going to be an actor. And he said, no interest, no strings attached, nothing. You pay it back when you can. So I got in to drama school doing a two-year course. And after the first term, I had no money to pay any of them. So I was back at Drury Lane. I was shoplifting food because I had no... I'd shoplift lunch.
Shoplifting Miss Derek Gurr back then.
It was, you know, it's a badge of honour, really.
Yeah.
And then in the theatre, the chefs knew that I was there, and I was stick thin, and they would give me leftover smoked salmon, roast beef. You know, it was a pretty good diet, let's face it. and then I started writing to people for money, and I wrote every lunchtime 3 letters, and I would look through Spotlight or whatever, or contacts or whatever. So I wrote, you name a celebrity back then, I wrote to them. Kenneth Branagh, Daniel Day-Lewis, John Gielgud. They all sent me money. Not all of them. Daniel Day-Lewis sent me some money. John Gielgud sent me some money. Beautiful check written from Coutts. Wow. Kenneth Branagh said he couldn't send me any money, but could he do anything? And I said, write to the Northeastern Education Library Board in Northern Ireland and ask them, even though they've already given me a full grant.
Because he's a Northern Irish boy.
He's a Northern Irish guy, yeah. So he did
hides
do that.
It well. Hides it as well he as I it. Hide my Scottishness.
Yeah. They gave me £1,000 toward fees and stuff. But it was £14,000, and I got the biggest benefactor.
Did you do the whole full 2 years?
I did the 2 years, yeah. And there was a Welsh girl at Drury Lane, and she was on the same wicket.
A Welsh girl.
She was lovely. She was great.
They're always good sports.
I can't remember her name. She was, and we were always talking about who we were writing to and who we got success with and blah, blah, blah. And she passed me on the steps, I'll never forget, and she said, I remember she looked at me and she went, Anthony Hopkins. And I went, what? She went, Anthony Hopkins. And we were between rooms or something, and we couldn't see each other. And then I came back to the end, so what did she say? Anthony Hopkins. I wrote to Anthony Hopkins, and he sent me a check for £3,000.
Wow.
Straight off. And let me know if you need any more. So I wrote to him again, and after
once
that...
Once a week.
Yeah, every day. And his first one was a personal check. The second one, he'd set up the Anthony Hopkins Trust or Foundation or something like that. And it was handled by his wife, Lady Jennifer, I think it is. And that's the time when he fucked off to Hollywood and they split up or whatever. But so he paid, I think, probably $8,000 of the 14. And then... dribs and drabs came in from other actors and stuff that I wrote, and hundreds, 200s, 300s.
What
and stuff.
Did you? What was in these letters?
Like, well, do you know what I mean?
How did you present this?
They were always on one side of A4. And
I've been offered many blowjobs and turned them all down.
Yes. Simon Callow has been the fool to have not received. And so... I don't know to this day, but I have got the old green folders box file with all the letters in it still.
Wow.
And it's in a cupboard in the attic, rather.
You should put those online to help actors.
Help actors.
Well, when I went to drama school, this ship had sailed by then.
Any
sort of like small thing that you can say, I'm going to the same drama school as you were, I came from the same town as you. And it had become a thing that, you know, successful actors were getting tapped up by drama students. And in fact, it was actually suggested to you by the drama schools.
Oh, really?
Right. But by then, obviously, every actor on the sun had been tapped up so many times by the ship had sailed. Mm. But my then flatmate, who was going to different drama schools than me, he got the idea that he said that he wrote to famous people and said, look, I know you've been tapped up 100 times for this, so I'm not going to ask you any money, but if you could send me a signed piece of memorabilia or something that I can sell to help my... And it sounds like a great concept, but, you know, 12 quid here, 25 quid there for a signed, first night program of something by Kenneth Branagh. So it doesn't go a lot. You know, you have to sell a lot of fucking signed photographs to get a year's drama school fees. But the most hilarious one that he got a reaction from Pierce Brosnan. That basically it was like it said, Pierce, I'm afraid cannot help you out. But if you'd like to join the Pierce Brosnan fan club, you will receive two signed photographs.
You see, if I was in the receiving end of that, and someone had written that letter saying memorabilia, I would have got, I like your initiative, and probably more likely to give them.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Charles's idea was. Yeah. That you know, look, I'm not asking you straight up for money. I'm not. Yeah. If there's any other way.
And that's the same with any angle you take a slightly. I met Anthony Hopkins, funny enough, at a BAFTA Awards at Drury Lane afterwards, and thanked him, and he was so gracious. I went up with a tray full of every non-alcoholic drink you could think of, because he's AA, and on the back of a card I'd just written, Sir Anthony, I'm Patrick Lennox, and you helped me fund it. I just want to say thank you. And I just gave him a drink, and I just said, here's a card for you, sir. And I walked away, giving him the chance to, you know, so he'd go out, and he called me over again, and we had a little chat, which was very nice. And he was, and he said, do you know what? He said, well, let me know if you're in anything. And I was in a couple of things, and he was in LA, but I should have. I wrote to his wife, actually, told her a couple of things I was in, but she never came.
He's an amazing performer, Anthony Hopkins. It's obviously, in his early days, he had the not only the chops but the inclination to transform and do the real hard work. But even now, in his autumn years, where he evidently does not give a fuck, he's still more watchable than anybody else on screen.
Yeah.
You know, he's no longer doing the transformation. He's not doing the Daniel Day-Lewis length and breadth. He just turns up to have a laugh on set. But he is still... In The Mask of Zorro, Catherine Zeta-Jones has obviously worked her tits off to get a perfect Mexican, Central American accent. Obviously, Banderas has that. That is his natural accent. Anthony Hopkins... turns up and he's just Welsh.
That's fabulous. And who does he play? Her dad or something?
Yeah,
in it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's.
And he plays the mask. Sorry, he's the sort of godfather figure in it. But for some reason, has a Welsh accent. Still, a billion times watchable, more watchable than anybody else on screen.
I saw that,
and he's phoning it in.
The Thor Thormagodden. What's that one called? Which is a great movie.
Ragnarok.
Which I'm not into that sort of movie at all. I was absolutely blown away. But Anthony Hopkins came up, and like you say, he just stole those scenes.
It's a great opportunity for a joke that I thought was missed out, because Thor goes to his father, played by Anthony Hopkins, and it's you know, I can't do anything. I've had my hammer taken away from me. I've got no power. And Anthony Hopkins says, you're the god of thunder, not the god of hammers. God, they have got to do a God of Spanners joke at some point.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Unfortunately.
Or he throws the hammer away and a large spanner comes back into his hand.
Multi-tooled.
Yeah, Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, the King of Swiss Army knife. What?
This is why you and I, with scriptwriters, wouldn't have lasted long on that project.
No. Marvel is not coming knocking on our doors. So when did you do your first gig? When did stand-up take off?
I did my first gig August the 21st, 2001. Oh, no, 1999, I think it was. I've still got the poster. When I say poster, I photocopied A4 sheet, and it was at the Laughing Cavaliers. I've forgotten the guy that ran it, but they used to do improv at the beginning. And
Was that at the Camden Head?
Camden Head.
Yes.
At the Queen's Head, Camden Passage. Is that it?
No, it's the Camden Head in Angel, which is now Angel Comedy.
Yeah. And on the bill, Pat Monahan and Jared Christmas, and my name written in biro at the bottom.
Nice.
Just scratched in at the bottom.
Nice.
Which might have been me. It might have been me putting that on. God, I'm not on the bill. But I remember, that was my first ever gig. I did a Jill Edwards course, because a friend of mine had done that course, and another friend of mine, my best buddy Connor Maloney, who'd done comedy in the 90s and had actually gotten TV and stuff and just turned his back on it, not interested. And now he's in Mrs. Brown's Boys. That's what happens to you if you turn your back on comedy.
Yeah. That, I mean, Mrs. Brown Boys is the back of comedy.
It is what it is. And I'm not going to say anything because it is what it is. And so I did this. Lots of people saying, you must do this. You know, you're funny. You can do da-da-da-da. And because I was an actor and I was doing lots of plays and touring and da-da-da, like sort of thing, I went and did this course thinking, oh, what, you know, what the heck? Why not go and do it? Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And did that first gig and just loved it. And then went off and did more plays and stuff. So over the next 2 or 3 years, I kept sorting off and doing plays. It's quite a few in Ireland and toured Ireland and stuff and come back. And of course, every time you come back, you've got to start again. People don't forget, you know, they forget who you are and stuff. And for me, I thought, because being an actor, you can conceal your nervousness better on stage than Joe Bloggs coming on stage. So everyone would say to me, how long have you been gigging for? And I go, you know, how many gigs have you done? You go, well, I've done 20 or 30 or something like that. And so Peter Graham gave me my first paid spot, 15, quite early on. Mm-hmm. And I remember 3 days before phoning up and going, look, you've got to take me off this bill because I don't have 15 minutes. And he was like, well, it'll be fine. Just come up and do whatever you... I said, no, I have 8. I have 8 minutes. And he was like, just come in and do it. Just, you know, do 8 then. Do 10, do whatever. And I've still got a recording of it somewhere on a cassette.
There are a few clubs better directed by their Peter at the King's Head in Crouch End. He still, although sometimes I enjoy sitting in the axe room at that gig more than the actual gig.
Yes, for the gloriously politically incorrect jokes that are put up by Peter.
Incredible showbiz stories of nether times and stuff. But he looks like he's not watching the show at all, and he'll have the most laser-like note for you. And you read about the early days of the Comedy Store, that they had a kind of artistic director who would give notes and stuff. And no clubs really guide acts anymore. You either are liked and therefore get rebooked, or you're not liked and don't get rebooked.
Yeah.
But no one really invests to develop acts, really. You're on your own very much in the comedy world. And I think it'd be nice if more clubs had a Peter Graham to pinpoint just something quintessentially where you're misstepping and, you know, not writing jokes or anything, not giving you material, but just sort of giving you a steer.
I think definitely, because back then, I'm sure it's the same now, and the open mic trying to get gigs was very, very difficult. And it was all done pre-internet, this is the thing. It was all done with timeout. Everyone had timeout. And the comedy section went over 4 or 5 pages. It was amazing. And the new every night of the week there was new act night, new act, open mic, all that sort of thing. And so you'd hunt to get them. But when you, like you say, when you got to Peter's gig, and he would watch your progression, and it was true that those words afterwards, and his ability to call people and not like them, I don't like them, I don't like their act, was, and at times I'd be going, come on, it's fine, we're, you know, it's okay. And then it would always turn out to be pretty much correct. The person was a wrong'un or whatever. And years of experience, I guess.
Have you ever had any notes from him yourself on your act or?
Your shit, get better. I think that's a note that goes through my head every time I walk off stage. Your shit, get better. I genuinely have that. You know, even when I go, that was good. Yeah, but you need to get better. You need to just get better, you know. And
Jeff Innocent gave me a note early doors where he said, what I think you need is more bits that make the audience laugh.
So Jeff Innocent said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't mess with Jeff Innocent when he said that. Especially when you first meet him, you go, Jeff. Yeah. I think when I remember had my first tryout with a Comedy Store, and Don Ward said to me, it's amazing, when I close my eyes, I hear Dave Allen, and I used to manage Dave Allen. You're Dave Allen, I want to see more Dave Allen, so come back and do more Dave Allen. I said, with all due respect, I'd love to be, but I'm not Dave Allen. But I went away and came back and kind of, you know, tried to do slightly longer bits and as much as you leaned towards Dave Allen. And it didn't go as well, but it went okay. And I came off stage and Jim Jeffries was on the stage and we were signing the sound booth and he said, yeah, that was good, but I want to see more Jim Jeffries. I want to see you take more chances and be more close to the edge. And I said, you just told me to be Dave Allen. He said, Dave Allen? why would I tell you to be Dave Allen? I said, because you used to manage him and you said that. And I was so confused.
It's a terrible bit of advice. Both of those are terrible bits of advice. Well, I can't think of a worse bit of advice than telling your act to be more someone else.
Yeah.
You should be finding who Paddy Lennox is. That's the job of a comic, is unravelling the onion and finding the truth. You know, what do you really think? What is your real opinions about things? Reginald D. Hunter's saying, decide what you really think and prove your point with jokes.
Right.
And, you know, when you hear somebody, you know, I see people come through here a lot who, you know, when I first started, everybody was wanting to be Stuart Lee or Eddie Izzard.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot of Bill Burr wannabes. And you can see it. You can see their pretend, you know, and it's, they may have a good gig and they may fool an audience, but they're never going to be interesting because they're trying to be somebody else. And ultimately, what are you ever going to have interesting to say while trying to be somebody else? You're only going to find something interesting to say when you really get to know yourself. So I think it's, with all respect to Don running one of the best comedy clubs in the world for the best part of 40 years, that's terrible advice.
I think you're right. But then trying to find yourself, I mean, I still listen to playbacks of myself and videos of myself on stage, and I go, oh, right, who's that?
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And the only time it comes across is in the club that I run myself, and I MC it every month, and I've now video it. Bishop Stortford and the Laughing Bishops Comedy Club, and must get you down for that. And it's suddenly in HD, and it's an amazing bit of video, and you can really watch it. And because I have to write new material every month for it,
yeah,
there's no pretense, and the audience know you. Yeah. After a year, 2 years, they kind of go, well, we know exactly what you're like. We know more about you than you would, you know. I meet people in the street and they ask me how my children are by name. And I don't even know who the hell you are, let alone how you know my children. You know, it's because I've talked about them on stage because, you know, you do that. Or my car, did you get your car through the MOT in the end? Oh, that was terrible luck with a policeman when I got arrested. You know, yeah. What? You talked about it on stage.
Yeah,
so you can forget. But trying to find the real person, I think, you know, even going since however long I've been going, I still haven't found, you know, it's like I'm watching myself in video going, oh, I should have done this ages ago.
Well, it's a constant, it's a constant development, isn't it? I mean, people sort of talk about these sort of penny drop moments where you find your voice. I mean, famously, of course, Jack D was meant to be this sort of chirpy chappy, eager to please, dying on his ass every night. And he's actually given up. He's gone, right, I'm not any good at this. I've been giving it a go for 2 years and I've got nowhere. I die more often than I don't. I'm knocking it on the head. But he had one or two gigs still in the diary. He didn't want to let them down, so he still turned up. But instead of being this chirpy chappy, eager to please, he was like, well, it's great being here. And people started laughing.
Right.
And this dour sort of like not wanting to be there. And he finds his voice and then the rest is history and becomes one of the most rich and famous comedians of all time.
I'd love to see the early stuff of him being cheesy. I mean, that if he put that in DVD and sold it,
yeah,
that would sell.
It would, but to comics, definitely.
Well, yeah. And because it's funny, I've still got my tapes, and one thing I was thinking for a podcast would be getting comics in to play, if they've got any recordings of their first gig,
yeah,
or notes, and we all have notes. I would have my notebooks from somewhere and say, play it. Or say it, or do it, and play that stuff back. Because I found this cassette, mainly because my middle child bought a stereo with a tape deck. And he was like, what's this bit in the middle? And I'm like, that's a tape deck. And he's going, oh, what? And I'm going, play tape. He had no idea. He's 12. He's no idea. And so we dug out some cassettes, and I found one at the back of a drawer. And it was a cassette from 93 or 92 or something like that for my material. And it's just, and it, you went on stage with big clunky, back then they were tiny, but you big clunky tape decks and just played, recorded every single gig you did. And I have these gigs and use Eddie Izzard. I'm channeling Eddie. One of them that I played in, it's just Eddie Izzard.
Yeah.
And
I think it's natural when you're new to, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not saying, I was an Izzard clone early doors. And I think it is absolutely natural to take on different personas while you're finding yours. I'm not berating people for doing it.
Yeah.
I just don't think it should ever be the advice to give somebody.
Yeah.
The advice should be, yeah, okay, play around with being Dave Allen while you find yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it does help to have a persona, to have something to play when you first take the stage. And when you're new, it's natural to emulate your heroes, but it shouldn't be the end game.
No, it definitely shouldn't be the end game. But I do find myself, you know, like if I watch Bill Burr and then, you know, you press stop and then, you know, I just walk around the kitchen making lunch as Bill Burr, you know, or something. It just it shits and giggles. But then I do that.
He's very like that, though, Bill Burr. He's one of those, he's got such a passion for everything he's saying. He's so angry.
Yeah.
And those comedians, you always kind of walk away. Like, I'm finding myself, even though I write scripts, find myself writing stand-up now. I'm never going to go and do it because I can't perform, but just doing that because I've been watching so much of these, like, Bill Burrs, and I walk around, I was like, what am I angry about? And then I'll just start doing these sets on my rage of the world.
Yeah.
And he is, they're just so influential. Another one, obviously, people that we clone after is huge 80s, 90s, died of cancer, smoker.
Oh,
one of the greatest.
Randy Minor, Bill Hicks, yeah.
Bill Hicks, yeah, of course, yeah, Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
He's the, you know, he was, once you see Bill Hicks for the first time, you just start thinking like Bill Hicks. He was just
Everyone was,
When I first started doing stand-up, I was a tour guide at the Tower of London, and I was, I'd fell into, like, I'd been going about 5 minutes, and I inherited a club in Deptford. Off Lloydie, the illegal street trader, who was unfortunately, as it turns out, going through quite a mental breakdown. But I inherited this gig when I was like brand new, and basically it was one of those gigs that if you turned up, you got on type things. You
right.
was like 15 acts on, or doing 5 minutes to an audience of 15 acts, and it was a terrible gig. And I remember one of these guys that I worked with at the Tower of London going, oh, a new act night with 10, 15 acts on the bill. Are they all trying to be Bill Hicks? And I was like, if only they were shooting that high.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all unfortunately trying to be Russell Brand or Russell Kane.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, Brand, but, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I very much enjoy the works of those people. But you think, if you are going to pick somebody to emulate, you know, go to the top of the tree. But We do seem to be going through a.
I had someone on my club on Saturday who will remain nameless, very good act, who I'd seen only in December at my other club, and had completely and utterly channeled James Acaster. And it was just.
I think I know who it was, yeah. Cause I was
just. I was.
A couple of Thursdays.
Fantastic, really fantastic. But I was like, flip me, that is, as James Acaster. Mm. But the angles and the oddness of holding the microphone and the rhythms and, I like it, I think it's fun. I just, you know, it's, to me, it's, you know, it only bothers the likes of you and me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That I think that, you know, that other, I mean, you just do the funny.
Well, great art always leads to an imitation, doesn't it, really? It has a spread. There's only, it could be so many individuals, right? And then everyone slightly imitates. It's the same across the board.
In all
painters.
Forms.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have Green Day if it wasn't for Red Hot Chili Peppers. There's a quite clear sort of family tree.
Mm.
You know, you've got, you know, what's his name? He used to host Nevermind the Buzzcocks.
Lamar?
No, Simon Amstel.
Amstel, yeah.
I think he gave birth to the savage geek. You know, he was kind of the first of a kind, in my opinion. And then the sort of skinny, nerdy, but with an acid edge.
Yeah.
Every time there is a sort of a mold breaker, a thousand more come in there in the wake. But that's, you know, I suppose it's natural, isn't it? I mean, t'was ever thus. So you got some new material tonight for the show?
Tonight? I have. I've got some new material, and I always seem to have new material on the boil because I've got to keep doing stuff, and I forget stuff that I've done only maybe once or twice, and then it's only because I've got my sound guy recording the shows that I sometimes look back at a recording and go, "Ah, oh, I didn't realize it." And I find if what happens is I write, as always, to the deadline of doing the show. Like tomorrow night's show, I've written some of the stuff for, and I'll have written it and kind of said it a bit, but I've not performed it. So I end up doing it that night, and it's a bit stilted, and my brain is buffering, and I've not learned the rhythms of it or something like that. And it kind of, nah, it's okay. And then I immediately dismiss it, don't do it again, which is stupid. So you just got to go back and redevelop. So at the minute, what I'm trying to do is go through stuff that is new, that's maybe only been done once or twice, and redo it, and keep redo it, distilling it down to get it to work. Which is, you know, seems a logical thing that I should be doing.
It takes a while, doesn't it? It's not just a case of writing it, taking stage, boom.
Yeah.
Routines take a while.
Well, yeah, because I did, I mean, a lot of my stuff metamorphosizes on the stage. So I take the rough idea and I've written the jokes and I've done the punchlines, but, you know, and then throw it around a bit. But I did 99 Club on Monday night, new material night. And I decided what I was going to do was just do pure joke. Pure, not even hello, good evening. And because I signed up for masterclass with, the American thing, masterclass.
Do you know the online.
Yeah, thing. The online. God.
Yeah, it looks very good. There's amazing people on it.
Yeah. Helen Mirren did that.
I've forgotten the name of the stand up that does the. It's just me with names. Used to wear a white coat.
Steve Martin.
Does
it. And I watched the kind of first bit, and I've not revisited it, really. Actually, I've not done anything with it. But one thing that he said in this thing is, when you're doing it, don't bother saying hello and how are you. And it's just wasting. Just get straight to joke. So I thought, straight to joke. And so I went up and did straight to joke, which I realised after the other acts going on, you know, quite needy and quite nice. And hello, audience. Oh, hi, please like me. How are you? And here are my jokes and how are you? And I just come on stage and go, boom, straight into joke, which I'd done on Saturday night and had worked very well in my club to sort of not really working that well.
No, just
the, one or two were okay. But,
I think sometimes, I mean, it's all very well Steve Martin saying...
just go on and go.
But I think there's a different dynamic when the audience already know who you are. When they don't know who you are, you do have to introduce yourself.
Yeah.
If you know you're just another comic. They haven't bought a ticket to see David Whitney. They've bought a ticket to come to the Backyard Comedy Club, and you need to say hello and introduce yourself so they get to have a moment to get to know you before you. But once you're Steve Martin, of course you don't need to take
time. He's got a different energy, hasn't he? He is like a rocket. He's just like, bam! And as soon as he's on stage, he's just gone. And that stays with him all the way through. It's just joke, joke, joke. No real breaks in between.
I think you're right. It's identity. I mean, Milton Jones would be... He can get out and do it, you know, just straight into his one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the joke I opened with.
Steve Martin's book, Born Standing Up, is one of the best.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, yeah. It's
a great book.
God, yeah.
I think the Jim Carrey comment on how to open is one of the best, that when he was going up, he was, you know, he was not getting the audiences to click with his jokes until one day he got up there and he thought, you know what, I'm just going to show that I'm not afraid. And that's where his, how's everybody doing tonight, alrighty then, without giving them to show that it's like, actually, I don't care what you think, alrighty then, and that's where that came from. And he said once he did that and he showed them that he wasn't afraid, it just clicked. Everything else came. All the same jokes, it just worked for him. And I think that works across the board. You know, that just, if you're a comedian, no fear. If you see fear, if they see fear, it's like sharks with blood in the water. They can smell it. Mm. And then it just breaks the whole thing down.
Yeah.
You've got to show you're just glorious and they do, and you don't give a shit whether they laugh or not. Mm. You are there to serve them, but you've got to not care if it's going to work or not. That seems to, it relaxes them.
Yeah.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Well, one of those opening styles we'll be doing tonight.
Just try all of them. Just do them all.
Yeah. Joke. Just do an evening of introductions. Mm. Just trying out a different way of saying hello.
It's a good Edinburgh show, my evening of introductions.
Are you going to Edinburgh this year? No, you're not.
I might visit. Right. Yeah, I've got a few reasons to be up there, friends and other things just going on. So, yeah, I've nothing on there, but who knows at this
point. Nice place to, it's great.
Are you going up?
No, I haven't been for years, and I didn't go last year, I went the year before just for 3 days and just saw lots of shows, stayed in a hotel, and it was great, and the year before I did the same thing, went to see lots of new acts and all that sort of thing,
And I think 2013 was the last time I did it. I did a 2-week residency at the City Cafe. And back then it was, you can't do 2 weeks, you can't do 2 weeks. I went, I am. Watch me. You know, I've got it booked for 2 weeks. That's all I'm doing. I like going up for 3 days. I think I'll go up this year again. Well, this year. But so much comes to London now. It's so easy to sort of go into Soho Theatre and what have you.
Soho Theatre has become a year-round Edinburgh show, isn't it?
It's very good. Although, having said that, I was trawling through Virgin Media on my TV because we just got a new box thing, and it was box sets, and was like, well, what's on this thing? And found Soho Theatre on there. And did you know this?
No.
It's got its own, and there are probably, I'd say, 10 Edinburgh shows on there.
Oh, wow.
I started 2 of them and realised I'm obviously getting too old, because I thought they were shit. I just didn't fuck, and I went, fuck me.
Well, I think
and I won't name it, but I genuinely, and I want all comedy to be great. Why wouldn't you want somebody to be great? And I was like, wow, this is style.
Well, I think Edinburgh and club comedy have become our two ships going away from each other, and the distance is getting further and further. What is considered a good Edinburgh show and what is good in a 20-minute set on a Saturday night in a club, and the two have nothing in common with each other whatsoever. And
but it's not even that. I can understand someone taking on a narrative journey through an Edinburgh 1-hour show. It's very different from someone doing a 25-minute punchy, punched-up set and what have you. It's just that when comics go and do an hour of punched up, really good, snappy, blah, 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 like usually a seasoned comic goes up there and does it, and they get totally disregarded.
Yeah.
And not even disregarded, hounded. Yeah. And you think, what?
Look at this cheap. Look how cheap he is with his jokes.
It's just sort of very annoying. it was a relentless hour of circuit-based humour.
Yeah.
And you go, an hour of joke after joke after joke, because in the circuit you need a punchline every
40 seconds.
Well, more than you need it. It's for a minute minimum. You know, that's what you need minimum. You know, so every 15 seconds you've got some laugh in there.
Yeah.
Well, what Edinburgh seems to want now is biopic plays about comedians. That's what all it seems to be becoming. It's like, here's my life so far.
Here's my split up with my girlfriend, boyfriend.
Yeah. My thoughts on Brexit. Yeah.
Hey, I've made a living out of tragic love stories.
Tragic love stories. I remember seeing Robbins.
Robin Williams?
No, John Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
This is going back, doing a story about unrequited love up there, up in the attic, I think it was, in the courtyard. And it was fantastic. It was really just such a lovely little story. I mean, I'd never say that to his face, but obviously. But that was great. It was, and it's got a place for it. But then you see the likes of Hal Cruttendon going up there and punching it out,
and
like no one else does, and being brilliant. And then a whole lot of other people in between. That God, there are a couple of people I really, really admire who went up there and did sort of like you said, biopic things. I was like, what the fuck? I mean, I went up and did a terrible one show. Who does he think he is? Which was based on my my family tree and stuff, and it was the most crushing experience of my life. I went from, I think I had something like 6 or 7 previews, and the middle preview, I think it was, or near the, it might have been the penultimate one, was at the King's Head with Lucy Porter on second. I was on first. I was packed, 120 people in there. Barry Cryer was there. My agent was there, along with the PR girl who's meant to be there, and I did it, and it flew from start to finish. Every joke landed. It was brilliant. It was amazing. And I remember coming off stage at the end like, fucking hell, that was amazing. Barry Cryer in the green room saying, Paddy, I don't know what it is, but you've got it, that was great, just do that. That was not like Peter Graham was going, that's amazing. And Hannah, our agent we used to share, was there and saying, fantastic, the PR girl's here. And we went for a drink afterwards, and the PR girl's going, well, that's ready to fly. We're not even putting a preview in. We just do that show. And it was purely scripted. It was all down. It was all done. Da-da-da. Took it to Edinburgh from Edinburgh. And the first show onwards, it didn't work. It did not work. It did not
The laughs were hardly there. It was boring. It was baggy. It was just awful.
What do you think? Why?
I have no idea. And I think, I remember Hannah saying, "What have you done? It's just not funny." And what I saw in the King's Head was
helpful,
hilarious. And I said, "Hannah, nothing has changed. It's scripted to a friggin' syllable." And she said, "Well, you need to punch it up more." And so I remember going away, which is an awful thing. You take something and you try ramming jokes in left, right, and centre. And that made it worse, if anything. And I came back and the PR girl came to see it and didn't return any of my calls after that. Couldn't get hold of her. All that sort of thing. And
that's what you really want from somebody giving £2,000 to...
Well, I mean, the numbers started off really, really high. And they just dwindled. And I don't know how... They started off particularly high, I don't know, because it was a really good premise and it was really, really good. And what do you call the lady that runs the...
Gilded Balloon.
The Gilded Balloon. Karen?
Karen Cott.
Karen.
Cotland.
She loved it.
Karen.
Karen. And then it just went Tanksville. And I was having a mental illness over the period of a month going, I don't know how to fix this. And my lesson to anyone is record every single preview, video every...
Really?
And then just watch it back. Because if I'd watched the King's Head one, you'd at least I'd know exactly where it went wrong. Mm-hmm. I got accused of cursing a lot when I was doing one of the...
I certainly do that.
I don't curse that much, but I was at Dunmore Comedy Club and I was emceeing and I was doing a new bit and I came off, my wife said to me, "Goodness, you were really cursing in there." And I went, "No, I wasn't." And another punter came up and said, "Oh, Paddy, I realized that, but God, you were cursing a lot tonight." And I had no idea. And then I watched the video back and fucking hell. it was fucking this and fucking
fucking. Turning the air blue.
Just, you know, and think, wow, that's just unnecessary. And to the point, I mean, I was aware of it, but I was irritated. I went, stop cursing.
Yeah.
I do a lot of script coverage for people. And one of the most common things I find in earlier and some later writes, before they sort of perfect the way to do dialogue, is they swear a lot. And what I always say to people is that swearing is fine. Swearing is fantastic.
It's big and clever.
Yeah, keep it special though.
Right.
Save it. It's a punchline. It's a moment. Don't say it all the time. Don't make it your vernacular. Just save it until you need it. Because it is, it's an extra bullet in the chamber to highlight something. And you do, you find it very commonly. People just, fuck this, fuck that, fuck. Which is fine, but it's not, it loses any potency.
Absolutely.
And that's the brilliance of swearing. It's great on the ear.
Yeah.
You've got to mean it.
Cool. Well, it's nearly showtime, yes. So we should wrap this up and go and do a gig.
Anything to promote? Anything you've got coming up? Your shows as well?
What have I got coming up? I've got my two little clubs, which I must get you down for, David. I've got the Laughing Bishops Comedy Club in Bishop Stortford, which is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I've got Dunmore Comedy Club, which they're both once a month. www.laughingbishops.co.uk or go to paddylennox.com and it's all on there. But I'm just looking at my diary to see when. I'm doing Top Secret on Saturday. I'm doing new material again on Monday. The 5th. I'm comparing the King's Head's new material night on Thursday the 8th, which is always a joy to watch new acts in there, and it's great. And then Brighton next weekend.
Thank you so much for doing the show, man. I hope you enjoyed doing your spot this evening, and hope to see you again here soon.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
See you again soon.
I've been married for a long time. I've been married for a long, long, long time. And my wife always has the same problem every year. It was my birthday just a couple of weeks ago. She says, "What do you want for your birthday?" And I say, "I want for nothing. I don't need anything in life, really. I'll go on. It's a big birthday. We need something special." I said, "Honestly, I don't need anything." She went on and on. "Something, anything you want. Just to shut her up," I said. "I wouldn't mind a threesome." Because she built it up so much, she felt a bit guilty. She went, "Well, okay. Who do you want of the threesome with?" And I said, to be honest, I didn't think we'd get this far in the conversation. So, I don't mind.